Welcome to the Paid in Full podcast. I'm Devin Fadul, and in this show, I sit down with creators of all stripes who have decided to follow their passion and carve out a unique path to success. My goal is to dive into their stories, learn about their philosophies, and share their hard-earned wisdom. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Paid in Full podcast. My guest on this episode is Jimmy Soni, author of The Founders, an excellent book about the origins of PayPal and its eclectic group of entrepreneurs, which we certainly discuss. But we also get into everything from writing practices to Roman history to parenting tips and on and on. This conversation was so fun and so wide-ranging. I could not wait to get it out the door. So without further ado, here's my chat with Jimmy Soni. So I've done a decent amount of research on you and your background. I want to kind of summarize it if I can quickly, and then I want to ask a question. So immigrated to the States, grew up in Chicago, ended up at Duke, started your career, I believe, at McKinsey. Mm-hmm. You worked at Huffington Post in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. Rome's Last Citizen, your first book about Cato, comes out in 2012. And then a couple years after that is the Claude Shannon book, A Mind at Play. Mm-hmm. And then most recently, 2022, The Founders is published. Great book, by the way. Where my question is I want to know two things. Like, where and when did you start writing, whether it's professionally or as a hobby? And then how exactly do you go from briefcase-toting, suit-wearing schlep at McKinsey to writing a book on effectively the Roman Republic, which, by the way, I'm a huge nerd. We'll get into that later. So how did that happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a good place to start, I think, because part of what I try to do when I am talking about my career trajectory is to make what I do, like, there's this sort of mystique or like a mystery around writers, particularly writers who publish with traditional publishers. And the problem is what that does is it makes the entire field impenetrable. And so part of what I try to do is just like tell my story with all the gory details so that people don't feel like this is something they can't do. And just for background, for the folks who are listening, like, my parents did not write books. We were immigrants. That we didn't even speak English in the house because I was born in France. So I learned Hindi first because my parents, then French, moved to the States when I was about four and learned English. And so this is not something where I'm like coming from a long line of people who are going to Manhattan cocktail parties and know every editor and author in the bunch in the, you know, in the industry. Like, the books I read came from libraries. We didn't buy books, didn't have money. So there's a little bit of like, I think my path could actually help other people who might be in a similar place or maybe even be a few steps ahead of where my family was. But basic gist is the thing that I think you start with for most people who are writing or creating anything is you have to love stuff that you're listening to if you're a podcast host, or you have to love stuff that you're reading if you're a writer. I just like always grew up like loving books. We always went to the library every summer, and the library was also weirdly, this will hopefully appeal to some listeners, like, it was weirdly competitive because they had these summer reading programs. And like the more books you read, like the more points you earned or whatever. And like you'd get random free things. One time Pizza Hut had this program about like where you get free pizzas if you read books through your school. And I remember I dominated this program. I was the Steph Curry of the Pizza Hut book program, right? And so I just love the competitive element of like reading more books. But then I also just learned to love to read. Everything. Choose Your Own Adventures, Garfield comics, the R.L. Stine books, Mossflower, Matameo. So as a kid, I read everything. And then I grew up and I just started thinking about like, well, I like reading. It made me a better writer in school. So then I started doing things like I'd write for the school paper, or I'd write for the yearbook, or I'd do that kind of publishing-ish stuff. And honestly, it was just a huge like ego thing. Like, you just see your name in print for the first time. I'm sure it was the same thrill when like you saw your iTunes page with your first podcast episode. You kind of get the rush. You're like, whoa, there was nothing there before, and now there's something. That is awesome. And the 0 to 1 for me, luckily, happened really early. It happened in writing stuff for my high school paper. Then I sort of wrote my college paper. And I just like always had the bug. Like, and I was always reading and I was always writing. And so then I was at McKinsey, and just like, you know, like a lot of consultant stories, maybe you had this story too. I loved my colleagues. I thought they were some of the smartest people I'd ever met. And the work was like mind-numbing. Like, I couldn't, like, it was so hard for me to do it. I did it well, but it was just so hard for me to get excited about like eking out operational efficiencies of 1% to 5% on these big companies, right? And I just turned to like, hey, I'm gonna find a side hustle where I get to do that, and that's the thing that I do. So I had been reading about the late Republic. I went on Amazon, there were biographies of Caesar. I went on Amazon. There were biographies of Cicero, and there's this character, Cato, who's at the center of the late Republic drama. And I couldn't find a biography of him. And it seemed really weird. He's like one of the three or four most important figures. He's the third or the fourth. And so I had this buddy of mine, Rob, a friend from college. We were debate partners, and he was just a good friend. And I knew he was a really talented writer. And I called Rob and I said, "Hey, man, you know what we should do?" This is kind of random reflecting on it. I said, "We should write a book proposal to try to sell a biography of Cato." And I think Rob's first reaction was like, "That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. We're in our early 20s. We don't know anybody in publishing. We're not historians. We don't like work at a university." I said, "It doesn't matter." I was like, "Here's why it doesn't matter." I said, "The only thing we have to do is like get really good at writing a book proposal. And if we write a good book proposal and we send it in, what's the worst that happens? It gets rejected. Like that just puts us back to where we are now. Like I'm working at McKinsey. You're working as a speech writer. Doesn't change anything." But I said, if someone happens to accept it, if like the lottery ticket works, dude, we'll have a book. Like, this is amazing. And Rob is really, he's a very indulgent friend. All my half-cocked ideas, he'd get on board with. And I eventually just wore his resistance down. So what he would do actually is he would come to the McKinsey office in DC. And we would just sit down like Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And that culminated in a proposal. So from there, we just sent it out to a bunch of agents. And this is the second part of the story. And sorry that this is a little bit of a longer answer than maybe you wanted. But again, the idea is like, I think listeners should know that it's not just like famous people on the coast who get to write books. It really isn't, especially not in 2024. So I didn't know what an agent was. So I'm like Googling how agents work. And it turns out what agents do is they read proposals and then they decide to take people on as clients and then they can sell those to publishers. So, I mean, we're nobodies. So I was like, we got to find an in. And so my in was I went to the Duke Alumni Directory website. And I had found this woman, Laura York, who was a Duke alum. And I was like, dude, she's more likely than not to at least like humor us and read the proposal. Everybody else will just reject us because we're not writers for the New York Times or whatever. I said, but this woman, because she has a Duke connection, she'll give the email a second look if we mention Duke. And so I wrote this email to her with the proposal attached. And what I said is, request for help from two Dukies, because both Rob and I had graduated from Duke. And I said, I don't need you to rep us. But it would be really valuable if alum to alum, you could tell us if this project has any hope at all. Like, I just need to know whether like we should abandon this thing as a pipe dream or whether this thing has any potential. I write it to her. She writes back really fast. She says, I'm really busy, but I'll get back to you when I can. I'm like, okay, great. Polite brush off. A week or so later, she writes back and she says, I read the proposal. I loved it. I want to represent you. And that was it. We suddenly had an agent. And then she went out and sold the book. And it was like the dog that caught the car. Rob and I were like, oh, we have to like write a book now, like go figure. So we would work Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays at my apartment and then Saturdays at his apartment. And the idea was like, it's just a good discipline when you're young and you have a lot of other things you could be doing with your time to have somebody that you're accountable to. So 4 days a week, every week for a whole number of months. And we had a draft and then we just worked to improve the draft. But that is the story of going from like of Excel spreadsheets, you know, and VLOOKUPs to Rome's Last Citizen and writing books. And, you know, people can come to these journeys, however, but I think that for me, the creative outlet was a way of consoling myself about like traveling and staying in hotels and all the consultant life stuff. It just, what I knew it wasn't for me. So I needed an outlet and this happened to be it.
Well, thanks for sharing. I want to dive into the book because I just finished it and it was amazing. But I'm curious, like those 4 nights you guys were together, you were writing, but were you actually doing research as well? And then how did you divvy up the time, especially when it comes to the accountability that you mentioned?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, again, like the more process that people can share, the better, because it helps other people. It's true in entrepreneurship. It's true in personal finance. Like the more you can actually share brass tacks, how did this work? So truth told, a lot of times Rob and I would just get together and we would sit in perfect silence. Like if somebody like were to look at it, it'd be actually feel really weird. Like he would come over, let's say around like 6:30, 7 o'clock at night. And then he'd sit in my living room. We wouldn't say anything to each other for like 2.5 hours. And then he'd go home. That's it. And the reason is because I knew that if Rob was there, I wasn't going to screw around because it was like Rob's time. Whereas like if Rob wasn't there, I mean, I was what, 23, 24. Like the temptation is just to like go and like watch Netflix or like to go play with friends or whatever, right? And so it was a forcing mechanism to sit in front of your laptop and write words. We split the entire book down the middle. We just alternated chapters. Like he'd do chapter one, I'd do chapter two. He'd do chapter three, I'd do chapter four, and then we'd swap. And in terms of the research, what's nice about writing about the late Republic and about Roman history in general is that everything has been excavated and everything's been translated into English. And so we knew enough Latin to be dangerous, but we didn't need to translate original sources. All the sources were available to us. And then what the challenge is, like, how do you take a book or concept like that and make it relevant for a modern reader? The real trick isn't like telling the story. It's telling the story in a way that doesn't make somebody like you have your eyes glaze over. Like, the whole point is that hopefully when you read the book, you're like, hey, this was fun. They like made this relevant for me. They made it fresh. I didn't have to go back and read Plutarch and try to decipher what he's saying. It's more of a, I read this, and as a contemporary person living in 2024, I get it. I understand what they're trying to do. And so that was the real challenge. And what was nice is that because both Rob and I were doing political speech writing, at some point I changed jobs. I left McKinsey and became a speechwriter. And both of us were doing speech writing. So the whole challenge of speech writing is like, you're trying to take some topic, Social Security, and make it relevant for an audience. So we just kind of applied that same framework to Roman history, which is, we're going to be rigorous in our research, but the whole trick is, how do you make these toga-wearing 2,000-year-old figures come to life for a contemporary audience?
So you made this pitch to this agent, the Duke alum. If she would have said no, or if she would have poo-pooed the topic, what's the alternate history there? Do you write a book on Caesar instead of Cato? Do you write a book at all? Like, what do you think happens?
It's a great question. And you can't run the experiment twice, right? I mean, depending on whose theory of the universe you believe. We had sent the proposal to like two or three other agents, but I know my own stubbornness, which is, if she had rejected us, I would have just taken it as an opportunity to prove her wrong. I would have just treated it as like, I'm going to make sure you regret this rejection. Like, you rejecting me is actually fuel for the fire. And I would have sent it out to 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 agents. I just wouldn't have stopped. And I've read about other creators who experienced this. And hopefully somebody listening who's like on the verge of like building a business, or like, you know, just got turned down for something, like maybe this helps you. But these days, especially when someone tells me no on a creative project, I just see it as an opportunity to make the middle finger to them even bigger. I mean, it sounds a little uncouth, but it's like, I use it as an opportunity to think like, boy, you're really going to regret when this thing's a hit. Like, you are really going to regret not getting on this train. And I think about like all the great projects that I know that have been rejected. J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter, famously rejected by everybody except for one publisher. Tim Ferriss, 4-Hour Workweek, which is a book that I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with, rejected by everybody and became one of the biggest bestsellers in that space of all time. There are so many examples. I mean, I've had some success with my writing, so that's obviously helps put a wind at my back. Even now, I've had projects get turned down, and I'm just like, nah, I'm just going to prove you wrong. I'll just find a way to prove you wrong, because I know what the market wants. I know what my readership wants. I know what they resonate with. So that's kind of the stubbornness angle. The other angle would be that I told Rob a second thing when we were doing the proposal. I said, hey, man, listen, here's the deal. If we write this proposal and nobody buys it and it sits on a dusty shelf, we still have like completed a proposal, which is a good skill to have. And then we also have this finished proposal. So if you're ever at like a cocktail party or something and someone's like, Rob, you should really write a book, you know, you can be like, well, what do we have here? It's my finished proposal for this biography. You might want to take a look at it. And so my idea was like, we always had something in reserve. So even if the idea wasn't good at the time, maybe it'd be good 5 years from now. Or who knows, maybe Rob or I do something and we blow up and we become famous. And suddenly people want to give us a book deal just because we're famous. So I was sort of creating an asset in the book proposal that I knew, like, it wasn't going to decline in value. It might increase dramatically in value. And at a minimum, I learned the skill of writing a proposal, which was like a good skill to have. I kind of saw it, and I see a lot of things this way. I try to think about like, what's the no downside proposition? And the no lose proposition in the case of writing a book proposal, if you're young, is you learn how to do a book proposal. Since then, I've written book proposals that didn't sell. And in some cases, I pulled back on a project because I was just like, I don't really want to do this. So my view was that I think if she had rejected us, I would have kept going. And then after probably 2 to 3 months, I would have said, hey, let's put this on ice, but it's always here. We can come back to it.
No, that's incredible. That reminds me of this idea that I just recently learned from Sean Puri from the My First Million podcast.
Yeah.
And it's this idea that I think it's called a binge basket, where it's just all your stuff. And you might be tweeting it. You might be publishing it on Substack. It might even be a book. Even if nobody's reading it, it's still there. It's like a library of you. And I didn't have a name for it, but I've kind of been doing that myself for the past however many years or months, and just saying like, look, I've written this, even if no more than, you know, my mother and my uncle read it, it's still there for somebody to say, oh, wow, Devin's got an opinion on this, or Devin can communicate that way. At the end of the day, it showcases your talent, so to speak, so much more than a resume or a LinkedIn profile. Did you think about it that way, or was it just...
I mean, remember, this is in an era where I think LinkedIn existed, but there weren't as many robustly developed social platforms. They were there, but I wasn't super active on them. And so the idea of the repository of knowledge, there was no Medium, there was no Substack, there was no ecosystem of podcasting the way it is now. And so that concept wasn't totally in my mind. Maybe it should have been. I probably would have been better off if I knew that. But it was more around this, which I think is a little bit of a different framing. Like, especially today, you can develop skills so easily just by doing stuff. And the tools to do stuff exist, and they're mostly free. And the gatekeepers who used to like have to give you the blessing to do stuff don't exist anymore. And so what's nice is, like, if you see all of this stuff as like skill development, it makes it less do or die. Like, I don't have to be successful. It's more of just like, am I learning the skill of doing this thing? And there's a little bit of like, it takes the pressure off of you. Like, think about everything as skill development, and then it just becomes a lot easier. Like, here's an example. Sometimes if I have a difficult client, I think, you know, man, this sucks. Like, it really sucks. And I want to strangle this person, but I'm learning the skill of dealing with a difficult client. And God knows, over the next 50 years of my career, am I going to have to deal with a difficult client again? Yeah, I am. Sounds kind of basic, but it's actually a good framing for changing the opportunity around. The other thing is that what I really like about what you said is that you also never know when something you're thinking, writing, publishing, or saying into a podcast microphone is going to resonate and take off like wildfire. You really don't know. And what's been wild to me about doing books and doing articles is the sheer randomness of like who finds you. I can't believe it. It's like one of the miracles of the internet. Like, I found out the other day that like one of my books is in a library in Kathmandu. And I'm just like floored by this. I'm like, there's no time in human history where that would have been true. And more importantly, even if it was in that library, I could never have known that it was. And I think that's just cool. It's like one of my friends calls X Twitter. He says it's a perfect randomness machine. You throw something out into the world, maybe it resonates with one person, and then that one person turns into 1 million, and all of a sudden you have a new opportunity before you, right? I think that that is very true. Meaning, like, the line that you said, having this repository of your own knowledge that you never know who's going to find it and resonate. I have this podcaster friend, Dorkesh Patel, whose rocket has really taken off. And like, Jeff Bezos like randomly replied to him at one point and was just like, hey, I really like what you're doing. And the next thing Dorkesh knew, he had like his pick of podcast guests. And since then he's interviewed like Mark Andreessen and like Tyler Cowen, all these people. And it was all because like of this kind of few moments. Now, granted, he's done a lot of work to make that possible, but I think the today me is like, man, I'm under indexing on what I'm putting out there. I'm not putting out stuff enough because the randomness machine is so powerful. Everybody ought to be taking advantage of it.
Well, look, the conversation we're having right now is a prime example of that.
That's right.
And I love that. I mean, when in human history could I have reached out to the writer of a book that I enjoyed? It's something I probably don't do a good enough job of appreciating, but it really is incredible.
Two thoughts to jump on that thought. And I hope some of this is helpful for listeners, helps shape their business lives and their entrepreneurial lives. One is, people underestimate the value of just sending your favorite creators a note and saying that something they did was great. Like, one, I just do it as a matter of habit. Like, I know how hard it is to make something. So I'm always sending notes of just like, if I read something cool, I just like send somebody a note. The number of friendships that I have formed, deep friendships at this point, just by sending a note to somebody to say, I thought this was really epically cool. Great job. And then the other thing is, I think people underestimate how important it is for even quote unquote well-known or well-established authors, podcasters, whoever, to still get notes that just say like, man, this was great. Like, I've done a bunch of books. My books have done well. You know, some of them have done better than others. It still like is amazing when some reader or whoever it is like sends a note. And it's the lowest cost way, I think, to like increase good karma in the world. And so to my mind, like, that's like a thing that's true now that wasn't true in publishing 30 years ago or 40 years ago. You would have had to go through my publisher to get to me, or like find my address and then creepily stalk me and then like send me a letter. Now you can just send an email or a post on LinkedIn or post on Twitter. I'm highly likely to see it. And I try to respond to everything that kind of comes my way as best as I can. And so to me, it's like super important that people like take advantage of this. Why aren't there more notes being sent from people who are listening to people who are doing stuff? I would say it's qualitatively different to try to get someone's contact info than it is to leave a comment on a video or a comment on a post. So that was one thought. The other thought is that I've recently, a friend introduced me to the work of Alex Hormozi, who I think is saying some really interesting stuff in the world of entrepreneurship and has a really great personal story as well. And he said, you know, he used to think that when he was like getting like 12 downloads an episode for his podcast, that it was like a bad thing. But then he would think about like, wait, if I had to do like lead gen for my gym business and I was in a room of 12 people, like 12 potential leads, that's enormous. And then he's like, when it grew to 200, that's like an auditorium of people. He's like, that's freaking epic. It would take me so much effort to fill an auditorium of people. And so I think scale, keeping scale in mind in that way is also important. It's why I love doing podcasts, because I'm like, you know, I don't really care what the audience size is, because you just never know who's listening. And then also, like, it would take a lot to fill a bookstore with 20 people or 50 people. So like, as an author, like, you're like, oh man, the chance to go on a podcast, like, this is amazing. You have to be judicious about how you use your time. But just a way of saying, like, small creative acts can actually be very high leverage in the internet economy in a way they never were before.
That's a great point. I second that. I second everything you said, especially the reach out to your favorite creators, you know, whether they're a YouTuber or a writer or whatever. You know, selfishly, when one of my 500 readers sends me a message, that means the world. It's an incredible feeling.
Well, the reason is because, like, so much of the creative life is a fight against self-doubt. I mean, every day, no matter how good you are, you still wake up and you're like, you kind of, the way a friend of mine described it is, like, you hate yourself for a few hours, right? Like, even while you're doing the creative stuff, you're like, nobody's going to like this. This is really going to suck. Like, everyone's going to turn it down. The critics are going to hate me. And so you're always fighting a river of self-doubt. And so when somebody, some random person from, like, the, you know, whatever corner of the world comes back and says, hey, I really liked this thing you did, honestly, it's fuel. Like, it's fuel that keeps you going. And it's not the only fuel, but it is important. Those small gestures actually do add up. I have a little folder that I keep in Gmail called Founders Wins. Anytime I get like a note or a good review or something happens, I just put a little label on it and then I archive it. And anytime I'm having a day where I just like I should quit, I should have gone to medical school, just like my mom said, like, I was a toy, you know, all that stuff. I just go back to the Founders Wins folder and I'm like, yeah, okay. I think this stuff is good.
Imagine a world where your financial future isn't just a series of guesses and hopeful projections, but a meticulously crafted strategy designed by experts who get it. That's ADDA, a financial advisory that's more than just suits and numbers. It's about understanding that behind every portfolio is a person, a family, a dream. ADDA doesn't just play the game, we redefine it. Personalized strategies? Check. A deep dive into your financial DNA? Absolutely. A partner who celebrates your wins and strategizes your next moves? Without question. We're not just in it for the fiscal year, we're in it for the long haul. So if you're tired of the one-size-fits-all approach, the impersonal advice, and the feeling that you're just another account number, it's time for a change. It's time for ADDA, where wealth meets wisdom, where plans turn into action, where your financial future isn't just secure, it's empowered. Visit addafinancial.com today, because your legacy deserves more than just guesswork.
Before we get to the founders, I want to talk about Rome's Last Citizen, who was very, very good, very insightful, but it was also highly readable, which is quite rare in the history space, especially ancient history, in my experience. Mm. I love Roman history, but I am particularly obsessed with the late Republic. It's just so fascinating. So my question is, why isn't Cato more well known? The guy played a key role in a key moment in history. But you asked 20 people on the street, I don't know if 19 are even recognizing the name.
Right.
So what happened?
There's a few reasons. The one big one, and this made writing his biography challenging, is he didn't write about himself. So Caesar was sort of the ultimate content marketer, mm-hmm. right? He would write third person histories of himself that he would mail back to Rome, and then they would be distributed and talked about. Cicero would write these long letters that he was going to preserve, and he would write these books that he knew were going to be preserved. Like, there's all this stuff from Cicero that's been preserved. We have like one letter from Cato in total in the entire kind of canon. And so what we have are stories told about him or other accounts of things that he did or participated in. And we have like kind of a history of his political class as well. So the biggest reason why Cato is not a more popular figure is he didn't do the things that someone would do if they were trying to become a historically popular figure, right? He knew politics, but he wasn't out to like legacy build in the same way that Caesar and Cicero were. And like, that's the biggest deficit in the record is like, if somebody doesn't write about themselves, it's actually very hard for them to be remembered 2,000 years later, right? There aren't many figures where they didn't write about themselves or weren't written about like minute by minute, and we know a ton about them. And so the mystery of Cato's life is like, how is he even still as relevant as he is? And it's because he was super important and very prominent. I think the other thing is, he was history's first like mainstream Stoic. And a lot of it's like Stoicism has come back in vogue in recent years. But part of what Stoicism teaches, or one of the things that it teaches, is indifference to people's opinions outside of yourself. You hold yourself to a standard, but you're not so moved by the opinions of like everybody around you. And so in a way, not being famous is like the ultimate example of being indifferent to everybody's opinion, because it wasn't like he was trying to make sure that his name was in lights, many, 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 many years later, or that people named things after him, right? Like the Caesarian calendar, Caesarian section. We have all these things that are named after Caesar. I don't think Cato had any interest in that. And part of that, what came from his Stoic teachings, which is that none of this stuff matters. It's all going to be ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And the thing to do is just try to live the best life you can in the moment. And so there is something about that that also makes it like, that's why he's not better known. And I think the other thing, and this is important, is like ultimately, not to ruin the ending or whatever, but Cato's project, preserving the Republic, doesn't succeed. Ultimately, Rome does become a dictatorship and the Republic dies. And so winners do tend to write history, right? And so because of that, you kind of have this figure that's written out of history. It's in some ways, again, even more powerful that he is like painted, that George Washington admires him, John Adams admires him, Thomas Jefferson admires him. All these people throughout history admire Cato, even though we have like one letter and a bunch of stories. And so that's kind of the reason that he's not better known.
This might be a clunky analogy, but prior to the musical that would launched Alexander Hamilton into worldwide fame,
Right.
I always thought of Cato as like the Alexander Hamilton of the Roman Republic, because he's number three or four in terms of importance, in terms of building the country or whatever, and next to nobody knows anything about the guy.
That's right. And now Hamilton's brand is arguably like stronger than like any of the other founding fathers because of that musical, right? I mean, people are rapping rap lyrics about him, and it can sort of show you how this historical life can have a renaissance. And so to me, that's actually one of the funny things about this whole situation is like now Hamilton is his brand has been resuscitated. Somebody ought to do a Cato musical is what you're trying to say. Somebody ought to come around and do a Cato musical. Lin-Manuel Miranda, if you're listening to this podcast, I'm all ears, man.
Yeah, the book's already out there. And yeah, I think was it Turneau that wrote the book?
Yeah, Ron Chernow. And by the way, I've had one dinner with Ron Chernow. Great guy, super nice. I bet he never anticipated that somebody was going to take like to speak about what we were just speaking about. You never know who's paying attention, who's reading you, who's listening to your podcast. Like, how could he ever have known that Lin-Manuel Miranda would be reading Hamilton and think that it could be turned into a musical with largely like rap lyrics? There's no planet in which he was thinking about that, and it transformed Ron Chernow's life. And the book is like a 1,000-page book. It's a very long book. And so you don't ever think when you're writing something of that scale, you're like, oh, yeah, it's gonna be on Broadway. Totally. This is a Broadway musical. It's like made for Broadway. Like nobody, like no sane person would think that. So I think it just goes to show, like, you really do never know who's reading your stuff.
Yeah, no, that's clearly been the theme of this conversation so far. I listened to Dan Carlin's podcast, Hardcore History.
Yeah.
Probably every episode, he kind of caveats what he's about to say with, "I'm no historian, but this guy's clearly an expert on several subjects." So whether it's tangible or meaningless or not, there is a line between author slash dilettante and capital H historian. Is there a clear distinction other than having a degree in history from a university that makes you a historian? Like, where does author stop and historian begin for you?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'm not actually sure I've ever true like I've thought about it a little bit, but I'm not sure I've ever like really reconciled it perfectly for myself, but I'll give it a try. One of the things that the historians do is, they use the tools of like the historian's trade. So you're looking at primary sources. You're trying to go back and find paper or some tangible record as close to the events in question as you can so that you can tell the story. That's different than, say, the tools of journalism. Like one of the tools of journalism is interviewing, right? So you can talk to somebody about a memory they had, but it can be very different from the piece of paper that might actually tell you what the hell happened. To do what I do, you try to do both. So with my book on Claude Shannon and with my book on the founders, sure, I was looking at old emails that Elon Musk sent, but I also interviewed Elon Musk. I was looking at old notes that Peter Thiel had sent, but I also interviewed Peter Thiel. Claude Shannon wasn't alive, but his kids and his wife were. I interviewed them in addition to looking at things that he had written and published. So for me, I think of myself as an author first, and then I use the tools of historian or I use the tools of journalism to get at the facts I need. I think there's probably people who would like quibble with me calling myself a historian. One of my friends is actually a real historian, like a PhD historian, who's a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he would quibble because he will take issue with the fact that my footnotes are not longer than my writing. But I'm sourcing and citing everything I'm doing. I'm also, my aim is to make things readable for people like you. It's to find passionate nerds who don't want to go back and read an academic paper, who don't want to go back and read Plutarch, but who want a story that's easily understood and readable and teaches them something new. I'm actually trying to do that. So it's weird because if like the criticism is, hey, your stuff's too popular, it's too accessible. I'm like, that's not a criticism. That's praise. That's what I'm trying to do. There's a reason why I don't write these and then publish them in academic journals. And there's a reason I'm not a professor. It's not what I want to do. I think that this stuff should be more accessible, not less accessible. I think that sometimes like the food fight on this happens more in academic circles than it does anywhere else. I've never had anybody come to me and say, you were insufficiently rigorous in your work, because I work like hell to make sure I'm not making things up. I'm not fabricating stories. I'm not doing the work that historians do. So I'm citing and sourcing everything. My writing is probably more accessible than academic writing, but like, that's what I'm trying to achieve. And so that's kind of like where I draw the line, is maybe a formal PhD holding historian can get a job at a university and can like write in academic journals. If that's what they want to do, more power to them. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make stuff that's a little bit more accessible. Now, here's where the Venn diagram overlaps. I'm a big believer that like in whatever you do, you should try to be adding something new to the thing that you're doing, right? So don't do the podcast that everybody else can do. Don't get the interview everybody else can get. Don't write the book everybody else can write. And part of that is like when I'm writing books, I'm always thinking like, what am I doing here that's new? Why should this be written? Why am I the only person that can do it? So that's like a bar where like, here's a good example. Like Elon Musk is maybe one of, if not the most covered figure in the world today, arguably top five for sure. I wanted readers to say, whoa, I learned new stuff about this guy because Jimmy just went for broke and like found stuff that nobody else had found. And I achieved that. And so to me, that's like part of the bar is how do I get over the like anxiety around you're not a real historian because you don't have a degree in history. Well, I'm just going to actually go further and find new facts. And I'm going to make sure my facts are super well referenced and sorted. And you're going to see pieces of paper you never saw before because I did my work. Call me whatever you want. You can't argue with the work itself.
So in The Founders, which is the story of how PayPal was founded, this might be a clunky segue, but who is the Cato of PayPal?
Who's the uncompromising man of principle in the...
I was thinking more of who's kind of the unsung hero.
Ah. So
who's the guy or the gal that gets lost in the shuffle of history?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say if I had to answer, it's Max Levchin. Max today is better known for being the founder and CEO of a company called Affirm. And he's not someone that is known. He's not famous. He's not going to host SNL, but he's one of the co-founders of the company that became PayPal. And within Silicon Valley, he's super well known and very well regarded because he's been a multiple time success as an entrepreneur. He built a company between PayPal and a firm called Slide. He was one of the earliest investors, I think the first investor in Yelp. He's a prolific angel investor, all the other things. And he's the unsung hero of that story. And I kind of kick off the book with him, even though like the tempting thing to do is to talk about people that everybody knows, like Peter Thiel or Reid Hoffman or Elon Musk, who are all a part of the PayPal story. I kind of wanted to flip the script a little bit. And when I did my research, I was like, you know, the earliest quote unquote employee or creator of this company is Max Levchin. And nobody knows, like in the public at large, really very few people know who he is. This is somebody whose story I really want to put a spotlight on.
What was it about the story itself that made you say, I want to spend years of my life and to write a book about this?
Yeah. I look back and I'm like, man, I aged like 10 years in the years it took me to write that book. Obviously, like one of the things that interests me is high performers and high achievers. I really like, you know, everything from like documentaries like The Last Dance to, you know, books like Hamilton. I really am drawn to figures who like are kind of just larger than life. And when you look across the landscape of Silicon Valley, the PayPal mafia, as they're known today, includes a group of people who have had and are still having enormous impact in all like aspects of culture and technology and business and everything else. And like your listeners, obviously, well, you'll know the name Elon. You'll probably know who Peter Thiel is. But if you've watched a YouTube video, the founders of YouTube started their careers at PayPal. If you've ever read a Yelp review, the co-founders of Yelp started their careers at PayPal. Palantir, Yammer, Tesla, SpaceX, Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, started his career at PayPal. And I went looking for a book on Amazon where I was like, oh, somebody's probably done the like PayPal origin story or whatever. And nobody had. And it was just, it like gnawed at me. It ate away at me because I was like, you know, yes, these people are all like have gone on to other things, but this was the first big success. Like this was the first win. And it was where they all came together and it's where they developed friendships and it's where they developed rivalries. How come nobody went back and ever did this book? And I was like, you know, what's interesting is like, as somebody who writes history, this is actually a historical subject, but my figures are alive. And so I was like, huh, maybe like I'm the right person to do this because when I come into the room, I'm not like a writer for the Wall Street Journal. I'm a historian. And it just happens that unlike Cato, I can talk to these people. Like I can be like, hey, you're alive. Tell me your stories. And so the fact that the book didn't exist was one motivation. And the second motivation was I figured that there was something about this story and this time in like internet history that was gonna be, it was like had affected everything else they did. Like I kind of like saw links between the playbook at Tesla and the playbook at PayPal, or the playbook at Yelp or YouTube and the playbook at PayPal. So I was like, you know, there's like a through line here. There's like a link. And so I wanted to investigate that. Like what was in the water when these people were all hanging out building this first success?
I'm no expert of 20th century business history, but in my, quick canvas of that period, the only company that I can even think to place in the same realm of collection of talent and kind of spinoffs would maybe be the Traitorous Eight that left Fairchild back in the 50s, I believe.
Yep, that's right.
So one, like, is there any historical precedent? And two, do you think that there will ever be a collection of talent like that in the future, or was that just a function of the boom in the 90s and some other lucky breaks that brought those 20 people together?
I would say, yeah, I'll take both questions. So on the first one, the analogous companies, you named one of the biggest and most important and the one that fewest people know, actually. So credit to you for knowing your history, which is the Traitorous Eight, Fairchild Semiconductor. That is another constellation of talent where these people just went on to do so much. Bell Labs is another. It's not that the people at Bell Labs produced a bunch of spin-off Bell Lab companies, but the collection of talent and the stuff they did there, like you and I are able to have this conversation because they built satellite networks, right? They built the transistor, which is like in every device ever. They built all these things that won them Nobel Prizes. And it wasn't, again, that they went out and built the next generation of companies, but that the things that were built at that company were really their impact was very consequential. The other one is Xerox PARC, where you had a bunch of people there who developed like the ideas that others, famously Steve Jobs, would use for their various products and services. But I would say, like in looking in the past, like in business history, there's no incubator like PayPal that I know of, where like everything went through that group, right? It's very rare. It's very, very rare. Your second question, I think, will there be another group like this? Will there be another PayPal mafia? I think there will. I mean, it's only a matter of like time, right? There are some discussions today about how there's a SpaceX mafia, that the generation that first cut their teeth at SpaceX and they're like off building new things. There are some groupings of this kind of talent internationally. So there are some like fintech players that have produced a constellation of talent, and those people went on to like become investors or new operators in new businesses. So I think it's going to happen. The challenge is you really do have a collection of like talent that's singular. I mean, it's one thing to have like a university produce a bunch of billionaires. It's another to have like essentially an employee roster of 220 people in Palo Alto that produces like the Elon and the Reeds and the Maxes of the world. And so there is something very rare about that. I will say, I think it's only a matter of time because you have an experience in building a startup that's so pressurized and so like you become so tight-knit and it's so hard that the people you naturally turn to in whatever the next adventure is will be the people that you used to work with. I don't know if it'll be as concentrated. I think it'll be a little bit more diffuse, but I think there will be another mafia. I just don't know which company is going to create it.
And judging by, relatively recent history, it's got to be in the tech or software space, right? It just, correct me if I'm wrong, but it can't exist in industrial metals or, you said, fintech.
Yeah, I would say I think everything is kind of tech these days, right? So even if it was industrial metals, it would probably be a startup within industrial metals. If it was going to be financial services, it would be a fintech player. You're unlikely to see a concentrated, let's say, like Goldman Sachs mafia, right? Outside of what already exists, which is that some of those top tier institutions do send their best and brightest in all these places, and they do end up doing interesting things. I think you're likely to see it within some tech version. Like, it's going to have to be tech for, I would say, for one reason, which is like part of the success of the quote unquote PayPal mafia is that they were all co-invested in each other's future ventures. And startups being what they are, they're a place where someone with, let's say, $1 million or $500,000 or $50,000 can make investments, as opposed to if you were trying to do what Warren Buffett did and like buy publicly traded companies, right, at valuations that you thought would eventually lead to wealth. Like, that's a very different game. And so part of the value of the Silicon Valley ecosystem is that when two people, like, let's say, I'll use a real example. When Russ Simmons, the co-founder of Yelp, early PayPal employee, and Jeremy Stoppelman, co-founder of Yelp, early PayPal employee, when they are sitting at Max's birthday party and talking about how they couldn't find a good restaurant review for the restaurant they were eating at, they were like, we should really create that. It's a very natural thing for someone like Max Levchin to say, I will give you the seed capital. Here's the check. Go build it. And I own whatever percent I own, right? That, I think, my sense is that's like, there's not the same analog. If you were like, we work at Goldman Sachs together, we have this idea. Oh, like our colleague at Goldman Sachs is going to encourage us to go do this and then give us his own capital to back it. It's possible that it happens, but I don't think it happens in as concentrated a way. I will tell you that even in my interviews with these people, they remain involved and invested in each other's lives in a very big way as friends, but then also as business partners. So I just, that's a 20-year history. I don't know where else that could be built outside of the intensity of a startup environment.
Did you catch the startup bug at all while you were doing the research and interviewing, like whether as a founder, an operator, or even like an investor? Are you interested in diving in or?
You know, I look, it's hard not to be caught by the bug just in general and culture. Like everything talks about is sort of startups and technology companies. I think that what's nice about what I do is that books are startups. There are startups where like I play every role. Like I have investors who are publishers, right? They give me a certain amount of capital. I have to figure out how to make that work. And I think that for me, it's like there's no greater thrill than doing the book thing. And the book thing, because it feels like a startup. Here's an example. You know, I have to raise money, quote unquote. I don't really have to raise money, but let's say I have to raise money, meaning a check from a publisher. I have to figure out how to get to product market fit. I have to make the thing good enough that readers like you are gonna be like, this is good. Like, I wanna know this guy. I would like this book and I wanna finish it. And then there's also like a release date, right? Which is like a sale or like an IPO. Like, I have a date at which I need to get stuff out the door. And then I think the other thing is like it's a fundamentally commercial activity. I'm not writing a free newsletter or book. I'm writing a book that people pay for. So the quality of the product has to be good enough that somebody's willing to part with their cash to actually purchase it. So in a way, I feel like that's my entrepreneurial venture. Could I see myself doing something else in the future? Absolutely. But what the founders made me appreciate is just how hard it is to build a business. It made me really appreciate and have a lot more respect for entrepreneurs because it is brutally difficult. I mean, it is excruciatingly hard. And the other thing is, entrepreneurs have to do what I don't have to do, which is I can write a lot of my books solo. Like, I spend a lot of time by myself doing my work, and I can track every day, here are the words I've written, here's how close we are to finishing the book. Okay, good. This day was a good day. Business is a lot fuzzier, and you can have a lot of dynamics among people that can throw a project totally off kilter, or you can find the wrong business partner, or you can find the wrong investor, or some crazy thing happens. And so to me, it just gave me a lot more respect for how hard it is. And I'm not saying no, but I also think I have so much respect for what entrepreneurs do now that I don't want to be one of these people that's like, oh yeah, I'm totally gonna do it. This is my next act. It's like, I'm gonna build a tech company. It's like, it's freaking hard. And I don't want to underestimate the difficulty of it.
So, The Founders was released almost exactly 2 years ago. Are you able to say, willing to say what project is next?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I have two projects in the works. They're very different. One more tracking with the founders, but the one that will be released this fall is a little bit of a different project for me. A few years ago, I met this incredible woman. Her name was Judy Henderson. And Judy was wrongfully convicted of a crime and was given life in prison for it. And she did not do the crime, but she did the time. And she did 36 years. And she fought for her freedom like every year. And in the 36th year of her sentence, like a governor finally looked at her case again and was like, wow, this woman should not be in prison. And the extraordinary thing is like she spent more time in behind bars than Nelson Mandela did. And she emerged a different and better person because of the period of incarceration that she went through. So I found her and I kind of encouraged her. I like bullied her into doing a book a little bit. And I ended up working with her on it. And so that project will debut this fall. And it's called When the Light Finds Us. And the idea is like Judy's life is the ultimate testimony to like how people can get through almost anything. Think like the female David Goggins minus the Navy SEAL with even more toughness, because the toughness to survive a wrongful imprisonment, I mean, it's unbelievable. It's otherworldly. So that book will debut this fall. We're putting final edits in on it now. And then my next project after that is I'm actually doing a close look at the life of Steve Jobs. So Jobs has this period where people know, you know, they know who he is. They know him for Apple and they maybe know him for Pixar. He had a third company he built. It was called Next Computer. He was fired from Apple in 1985, famously. And for 12 years, he builds this other computer company that is eventually acquired by Apple. People skip over this part of the history, but this is like a third of this man's adult life. And it's kind of an important period of his life. And not just that, the computer company Next, it's like the Velvet Underground or like the 90s Bulls. It's got like everybody, so many important things and important people came out of that company that nobody has gone back and studied. And I've done a bunch of interviews and I'll continue doing a bunch of interviews, but I'm kind of trying to get at like what happened there. Who are the people who made it possible? And like, what happened to this story? What happened to this company? Because it hasn't really been written about in a serious way. And so that's the next adventure. And I'm like, you know, 75-ish interviews in. I'll probably do a bunch, several hundred interviews along the way. But it's an exciting project because it also, you know, we tend to do this thing to entrepreneurs. Like the moment they're successful, we put them on kind of like Mount Olympus. And where I start my story is the story of Jobs, of a very public failure. You know, he is like the board fires him and then sues him. And so for me, it's like this very interesting moment of like, you're Steve Jobs. You've had this incredible, brutal failure. You've been kicked out of the company you created. You made Apple and they kicked you out. What do you do now? I think everyone I know that's successful or accomplished or has built something goes through some version of that. Maybe your failure was public. Maybe it was private. Maybe it was with your family. Maybe it was with a business, whatever it was. And like, the success stories on the other side of that get told, but the most interesting stuff is the rebuilding, right? It's the like, ah, like I have to make this work now. And that to me, I was like, I want to do that, but with somebody like Steve Jobs. And it turns out there's so much about this story that people don't know. And so it's already, I'm only a little bit into it. And already it's like, oh, this is going to be a book that maybe challenges some people's notions of who this person is and who this company was or what this company was.
I would imagine right now, I mean, forget right now, probably for the last 10, 15 years, you haven't had much time to read for pleasure. So how do you
Yeah.
kind of bifurcate? How do you distinguish between reading for fun and reading for work?
Oof. Yeah, this one's tough. And it's not honestly, and I don't know that this is true for all writers, but I have heard other writers say this, like Michael Lewis says this. I especially when I'm in the middle of a book project, it's all utilitarian reading. I'm reading with a purpose. It's like I'm reading because I'm trying to suck some marrow out of something. I'm not reading because I want to enjoy the wordplay. I don't know what other people's process is or how they read. I have to read every day in order to make sure I have all the information I need to write a book. And here's the reason why. If someone else has said it in a book, my bar for what I have to do is suddenly higher. If you could read what I'm gonna write in the Walter Isaacson book, then you would just read the Walter Isaacson book. But I want you to have a reason to read the new Steve Jobs book. And the only way that I can square that circle is by literally reading like 30 years worth of books on Apple and Microsoft and everything else. So I kind of have to do this thing of like, I say no to like all other books, blinders on, total focus. And that's kind of how it has to be because otherwise I'm not doing a service to people. Like, I'm sure you can appreciate this. Media competes with all other media. Your podcast like is competing against Netflix. My books are competing against Hulu. And so you have to do good stuff, and the bar has to be really high because people have to want to spend time with you and spend a lot of time with you. And so that's why the reading is necessarily like, okay, it's all Steve Jobs right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. These days, I can quit a book within a page, man. If I'm not feeling it on page one, I'm out
Yeah.
because there's literally 25 million right behind it that I can just pick up in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
I'm drowning in content, and that's a good problem to have. But
Yeah, no, me too. And it's an attention span thing, and it's hard. It's like very hard. I get it. What I would say is like my habit or my best habit when I'm not writing books is just I just read what I want, and like I read what engages me, and I will put books down, and that's okay. Not every book is for every person. I have an 8-year-old, and one of the things I tell her is just read what you want to read. Like as long as you're reading, it doesn't really matter. Like you'll find the stuff eventually that you need. Just keep reading. Like I don't, and she's reading these like graphic novels right now where they do like little comic book style explanations of stories. And I'm like, great, just stick with it. Just do that. Like I read a lot of Garfield growing up and I get to write books. So something about that worked.
yeah. Well, on that note, we're both hashtag girl dads. We both believe in the power of reading. And I've kind of this philosophy that as a parent, if I can instill in my kids the love of reading, that's half the battle. So I'm curious, have you, what are some like tips or tricks to instill that in your kid and in other kids? Any ideas?
Yeah, it's the great question. And look, I'm only 8 years into the parenting racket, right? So you might have more tips than I do. I would say one thing that's helped is that I, not an unlimited budget, but I basically have given her carte blanche to ask to buy any book she wants to buy. She knows that the distance between wanting to buy a book, me ordering it on Amazon and it arriving is very short. And so the faster you can make that synapse fire, the better. And for readers who don't have money, like just take them to the library, right? So like it's not a question of means, it's a question of just being resourceful if you don't have the resources. And to me, it's like I give her basically carte blanche to ask me to get any book or any series that she wants, like she's allowed to have, because I figure that's like step one. Step two is we actually visit a lot of bookstores, and I will let her buy like maybe two or three titles at a bookstore because that's exciting. There's still something about being in a bookstore and it being a tactile purchase and whatever that really appeals to kids, I find. There's a tip that another parent gave me, which is they were like, the best way to do it is just to let them be authors of their own reading and like let them control that process. And one of the best ways to do that is to take them to a bookstore and just say, buy whatever you want, right? So that's kind of another tip. And then the third thing I would say is, and I'm not the best at this. Like, admittedly, I'm not the best at this, but kids are great mimics, right? They'll copy just whatever you do. So I happen to be in the book business. There are a lot of books around. I read books all the time. So if she sees me reading, she's more inclined to read. A great example is like we were on a flight a few days ago, and I just consciously said to myself, like, just read the book, just read the book, just read the book, so that I knew she'd see that even on this flight, when you have access to this video screen with endless amounts of movies and shows and things, that you can take time to read. And then what I did, because I knew there would be a little bit of resistance, is I basically played a game with her and I said, look, here's how we're going to split up the time. You get 20 minutes where you and I will be reading. Then both of us, you and me, I'll do 20 minutes of laptop time. You get 20 minutes of iPad time. And then for 20 minutes, we'll watch something on the Delta video screen. And so I was like, we'll just break the hour into thirds. And that logic made sense to her. Like, okay, that works. And so you just kind of do that. But I don't have any special hacks other than that. I would say the other thing that I do that might help is that I read to her every night before she goes to bed. It's just part of our schedule. Like she's gonna brush teeth and then we're gonna read every night. Whether any of this will work, who the hell knows? I have no idea. But to me, the biggest thing is I encourage her to follow her own curiosity, to follow her natural drift, is I think the line that like Paul Graham used. And so if her natural drift is like graphic novels about whatever, and like go buy those, read those, you'll be fine. One thought on this that actually comes to me from my own life, but then from other examples I've seen, which is kids really do respond when they're allowed to be the ones choosing. Like autonomy, I find, is underrated as a parenting technique. And it can be autonomy within boundaries. So, like, one of the things that this friend of mine taught me is she said, you know, it's like one thing to like say to kids, like, here's what you have to eat. It's another thing to say to a kid, well, between these three choices, what would you like? Between blueberries, blackberries, and strawberries, what's your preference, right? Because then they feel like they're pulling one over on you by choosing, by deciding. And so that applies just as well to books. When I tell my daughter what to read, she's not going to want to read it. But when I say to her, we're in a massive bookstore, what would you like to read? And I am not judgmental at all or opinionated at all about what she picks, beautiful. Like she'll stick with the book because she was responsible for purchasing it. And it seems small, but it actually has had a big effect in her just desire to pick up books because she's picking up books that she chose, not that some authority figure chose for her.
Couldn't agree more, man. Yeah, second every single point that you made. You had started a pod for your daughter and then some other kids in the neighborhood when COVID hit and then the schools went to shit. I want to hear a little bit more about that, but I also want to hear if that's continued. And if not, what are your plans and thoughts for her education as she grows through middle school and into high school? I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no. I'm happy to provide them. And I just to like the important disclaimer here is I'm no kind of expert on this, right? Like with books, like I'm not an expert, but I've done it a few times. I've done the rodeo and kind of know what I'm talking about. And in the pandemic times, parents of young kids, you are just trying to keep your head above water and stay sane, right? I have no judgment on parents who did remote schooling, and I have no judgment on parents who did the other thing. Parents were just trying to survive. I don't think any of my non-parent friends actually understands just how tough the pandemic was for a lot of parents because it electroshocked every part of a normal kid's life and it cut off all these social avenues, and education was obviously like a big part of that. So the short story is I recognize like New York public schools were going to be remote. I recognize that I work from home. And I recognized that there was just something about remote schooling where I was like, being on an iPad all day is just not going to be satisfying because an experience is not going to be satisfying. And I knew a friend of mine had done homeschooling for his child in a small group setting. So I reached out to him and I basically said, look, I don't know that I could recreate what you recreated, but I can, the ante at the table that I can provide is that I can retrofit my apartment and I'll just go work from somewhere else during the day. We could turn this into a school. One of the hardest things about pod schooling is actually the location. It's not even finding other parents who want to do it or finding a teacher. It's actually like the venue. The venue is very hard to find. So he's like, you just solved our biggest problem. Great. And I sort of like, there was like a half moment where I was like, oh crap, what did I just do? Like, what did I get myself into? But what happened is we found four other families and we banded together. We put up an ad on Craigslist saying, like, looking for a teacher for a pod school. Got a bunch of applications and resumes. Interviewed several, had a couple run like little test groups with the kids. And that was the pod school. None of us were educators. None of us had like certifications. We just found a teacher who was remarkable, who really is the person who made all this work. And we built it because we needed to solve a problem. All of us kind of recognize like our lives are going to get materially worse if our kids are at home on an iPad. And if they're anywhere else with an adult with even like five other kids, they're just going to be a lot better off, right? And we also, though, knew like we want this to not just be daycare plus, it has to be educational. There has to be a curriculum. They have to be reading and learning things. And so what we did was we basically like during the day, my apartment kind of converted. We had all this like fold away Scandinavian furniture and mats and stuff. And we would turn it into a school. So at like 8:15, the teacher would show up. She and I would put everything of mine away. We'd put everything of the schools out front and center, and these kids would show up, shoes off, wash your hands, sit down on the morning mat, do morning time, blah, 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 all that stuff. And that was basically how I built it. And I will tell you, it was one of the more remarkable experiences I've ever had. It showed me so much about what education can be and is. And in the end, for a number of logistical and other reasons, my daughter returned to public schools the following year. So she would have been in kindergarten. No, she did. She would have been in first grade. She did her second grade at a traditional public school. And I would say that, like, there was so much about that small group experience that I miss. If nothing else, the like 6-to-1 student teacher ratio is kind of, you kind of can't beat it, right? You have 100% access to your teacher. They can tell you things that they might not be able to tell you when they're managing a class of 20 to 25 people. And I think there are also a ton of advantages to just like public school and the resources they have, clubs, activities. You know, there are all these like things that I wouldn't think to do that a public school can offer or a private school can offer. It definitely showed me, though, that like anything else, the modern school system is like a system that we've built with certain rules and regs, and those rules are all fungible. Like everything about education is fungible. And I think it forced me to take more of an active role in her education, right? Because when you're running a pod school, there's no administration. There's no, it's you. You are the administrator. And like you have a teacher and you have to work with them hand in hand to make sure the experience is good. I could see myself doing it in the future in the right circumstances, like running another school like this. And I think there's going to be a bunch of models that pop up. I mean, there already are to like support this kind of learning. I will say for parents who want to do it, you'd be surprised how eager other parents are for something like this. And if you can be the person that makes it possible for other people, like getting people to sign up for it is actually not that hard, especially in the pandemic context. But it's far easier than you think. I think the other lesson that I took away from it is there are a lot of teachers who are hungry for this kind of system. What they love most is teaching kids. They have to do a lot of other things when they're a part of a traditional school system. And it's a little bit bureaucratic, right? As all systems become. And so I found that it was actually like great for the teacher, great for the parents, great for the kids. It was like a win all around. And I look back on it very fondly. And it's like, you know, it taught me a lot. It's a lot of work, but the startup cost is worth it.
You mentioned there are resources out there. Do you have any go-tos for parents that would like to look into it?
Oh man, I can't remember the name, but there was some app. There were a bunch of apps that popped up. There's also like people should know their curriculum available online. Like you can download and buy and pay for like curricula that other people have created. So you could, for example, like pay for another second grade teacher's like lesson plans for math. And then you have access to something that a teacher that you hire could use to teach your kids math. So you're not kind of like making it up as you go along. I think the other piece of it is like almost everything that we bought, quote unquote, was like IKEA furniture or like random things that we could like find or somebody would donate. And it was not a very like just to disabuse people of like it, we were paying less than we would pay to put my daughter in private school and more obviously than we would pay for public school. But it wasn't a break the bank amount of money, especially when you pool resources with other parents. And like, by the way, our numbers, it's just the way it worked out. It was like six girls, and that's kind of how it happened. You could do fewer, you could do more. I've heard of pod schools that get as big as like 10, 15 people. It's a matter of personal preference. So I don't want people to think either that this is some like thing that only super, 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 super well-off people can do. I'm sure they have it a little easier, but like most of the families doing this, they were, you know, career professionals, like they have normal working lives. And so that, like, those resources can be as big or as little as you need. If you think about the mechanics of it, it's like you have smaller class sizes, more personalized instruction, flexibility in terms of like hours and days and times and other activities. You can decide to do things and change fundamental systems or events. But here's a good example. No schools went on field trips during the pandemic years. Like it just was like not going to happen, especially that first year of the pandemic. The girls that were in our little pod school went on multiple field trips because all we had to do was get a parent to agree to take them there and figure out what it was going to be. And so they were able to like quote unquote break the rules without really breaking any rules because like we set the rules. And so there was a little bit of just flexibility that comes in doing this that I think will appeal to people who maybe like had a run-in with a school where they were like, oh, I want to do this thing, but they didn't let me.
Yeah, well, similar to the late Roman Republic, the system is bulky and bureaucratic and sclerotic and just not built for what we've got these days, at least the
That's
technology.
right.
That's a whole separate podcast, to be honest. Well, listen, man, I know you got to run, so
Ironically, I'm going to go pick up my daughter at school, which is the reason we can't continue, but we should have a part two. It feels like there's so much we could talk about, subjects we haven't even touched.
would love to do a part two. Outside of checking out the books, any place that my listeners can find you?
You know, I'm active on all the social platforms, probably most active on Twitter X. So I'm at Jimmy A. Soni there. Follow me, send me stuff. I love interacting with readers. So that's probably the place to connect with me or email. Email is good too. So just hello at jimmysoni.com is great.
Wow, beautiful. I have one closing question that I always forget to ask that I'm about to ask you, and it is essentially, if you could witness any historical event firsthand, what would it be?
Oh, man.
Take your time.
Oh, that's a really tough one. That's a tough one because there's so many I would want to witness.
Can I throw one out there? I mean, yeah, there's a million. I mean, come on. But maybe number one, this is a huge maybe. The first interaction between, the Mexica, the Aztecs, and Cortez and his crew. I mean, that's like aliens meeting Earthlings. Like,
Yeah, that's right.
it would be like landing on an alien planet and seeing this civilization, this technology, these people that you had no idea existed, and how that would maybe be my answer. What are you thinking?
This one's really tough for me because there's just so many periods where I'm like intrigued by them. I think one big one for me would be being in the room, if you could be, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I know there have been movies made about this and books made about this, but there's basically like no, like there's like very few where there's very few moments in history where like that the outcome of that could have determined the future of civilization. And the way that that gamesmanship was done, the way that Kennedy responded, like it really did pull the world back from the brink when every, like so many voices in the room were saying that this is like, this is when the war starts. This is when the United States has to attack, you know, these Soviet missiles in Cuba. And like somehow we managed to avoid nuclear war. And I would love to like be a fly on the wall during that. I would say the other one is to be in the control room, like at NASA, when some of the consequential like moments happen, but particularly like the Apollo missions. There's still something about space and space exploration, the final frontier, the scale of it, the challenge of it, and like these teams of people that make this happen on the ground, and like to be in the room when like that's happening. I mean, that's like NBA playoffs and finals are played every year, but like you don't do a moon landing every year, right? And so there's something about that that's like so world historic that I would want to be in the room for that. And then I would say also some of the debates around the creation of the American Constitution, I think, are just really interesting. Like, I think it's like wildly interesting. And the people there, again, are like larger than life personalities. We talked about Hamilton, but all Madison, Jefferson, et cetera. I think that would be very, very interesting. There's too many to name, man. That's the
We could riff on this all day, man.
We should.
I'm gonna let you go. Yeah, go pick up your daughter. Have a great weekend. Let's tentatively plan for a part two at some point in the future. In the meantime, good luck with the projects. Let me know if I can help in any way, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Evan. I really appreciate it. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, me as well. Take care, Jimmy.
Bye.
See you.